C1R. Number 17A.
Here we go now to the last three questions in the category of Christian Science, the fourth side of the Holy City Science. Here, from the absolute standpoint, we consider the Word. Well, from the absolute standpoint, naturally, we would see that the Word would have to tell us something about that scientific understanding. We have, as an overall subject, we have understanding is being. You see, before we had the way to understanding, now that we have somehow touched the form of understanding, then we can see that understanding is something that always demonstrates itself as our being, as our consciousness, as our experience, so that understanding becomes being. And actually, this is the main point that we can see. We try to understand Christian Science in order to find our true being and not something else. So, first, from the point of view of the Word, we will see that this scientific understanding is, so to say, our health. And consequently, the question is quite understandable here. Will you explain sickness and show how it is to be healed? So we have again a question on healing here. We already had one before, you remember, where we began to see that these explanations have to be understood in order to heal. Now it's a step further and show how this is possible. So, because it is a question of healing, and healing is always something that is practical and that should really be our main concern too, next to understanding the science, I think it's the best thing, we read that together again, always with the purpose of seeing how we can find out the epitomes, how we can reduce a longer text to a shorter text, so as to get an overall view of what is the line of reasoning. You see, it's a great point to find the line of reasoning, because the moment we find the line of reasoning, and when we see that it follows along an order of the seven synonymous term, no matter if it's the Word order, the Christ order, or if it's along the Word, Christ, Christianity, and Science, we have a leading, and that helps us in understanding. So the very first paragraph here is not very interesting insofar that it says the method of Christian Science mind healing is touched upon in a previous chapter entitled Christian Science Practice. So she wants to say, really, the answer to this question is so big and so involved that she has written a whole chapter on it and refers to that chapter. Yet, for a beginner, for the student who enters into the field of Christian Science, she feels that recapitulations should somehow recap the main idea of healing, and therefore here is a short recap of it. A full answer to the above question involves teaching, which enables the healer to demonstrate and prove for himself the principle and rule of Christian Science or metaphysical healing. So this whole paragraph we can see is an introductory paragraph. It doesn't really say anything about the question that has been asked. It isn't, therefore, the body of the answer, so that only afterwards, with the next paragraph, we really get an answer to the question, will you explain sickness? And the very first one tries to explain first what sickness is. we read it together and I comment on it as we did before. Mind must be found superior to all the beliefs of the five corporeal senses and able to destroy all ills. So it's she starts right in with a absolute statement, and without reasoning it first out, she says, mind, capital M, must be found superior to all ills and be able to destroy them. So we get here an answer, show us how it is to be healed. Mrs. Eddy would say right away, the only healing is through the divine mind. Sickness, only now she explains what sickness is. Will you explain sickness here? Sickness is a belief which must be annihilated by the divine mind. So here you have a good answer to that question. What is sickness? Sickness is belief. Will you explain sickness? She asked. Yes, I don't explain sickness as a sickness. If you ask a medical man about the sickness, he will tell you all about that sickness, the symptoms, how it operates, what is the matter with that sickness, how it can be healed, and so on, and so on. Whereas Mrs. Eddy comes and says, no, we don't have to know anything about the medical aspect of it. We have to translate it right back to its origin, to the mental origin, namely, it is a belief. The moment she touches on belief, naturally, she also has the answer for that belief and can show that is actually mind that will always take care of belief and claim of a belief, because belief is formulated in the human mind, in mortal mind, and that which is the answer for the human mind, mortal mind, is the divine mind. So it must be annihilated by the divine mind. Disease is an experience of so-called mortal mind. Again, she explains it further. First she has said it is a belief. Now, even Fersen says this belief is mortal mind, so that we are quite clear that we never deal with a material concept or material substance of a disease, but always with a mental concept, with so-called mortal mind. It, disease naturally, is fear made manifest on the body. So that mortal mind, as one of the great component, is fear. You know that in the chapter on practice, she would show that there are three great causes within mortal mind that cause disease. The one is sin, the one is ignorance, and the one is fear. Actually, she puts it in the other order. It's actually fear, fear, ignorance, and sin. Now, here again, it's a summary showing that this mortal mind manifests itself through fear, and that shows itself forth on the body. Christian Science takes away this physical sense of discord, just as it removes any other sense of moral or mental inharmony. Here she enlarges the text and says, what I have stated before, that mind heals, is not only true for disease, but is also true for moral and mental inharmony. So that she covers now the question, will you explain sickness, will you explain really mental and moral inharmony? So this is the point here, that she enlarges the term sickness and shows it that all that is as its origin in mortal mind, therefore the only medicine that we can have is the divine mind. Here in the middle of the paragraph, which is quite seldom, but it happens here and there, the tone changes. So up to this point, we had the marginal heading, mind destroys all ills, so under all ills, she means not only disease, she also means moral and mental inharmonies. So that whatever the problem is, we always should work it out spiritually and always should go back to the divine mind and not to the human mind and not argue with the human mind, but put it right back into the divine mind wherein is all cause of a solution. We epitomized this like this. Now you can see that this epitome more or less contains everything. That sickness is what? Will you explain what sickness is? Sickness is a belief of mortal mind. Will you explain how it is to be healed? The answer is, which must be annihilated by the divine mind. So I think already this answer is more or less an answer that covers the basis of Christian Science healing. So all that comes further is built on that basis, and the text goes to the tone of spirit. She says that man is material. You hear at once, she now takes up the materiality of man or the disease, that man is material, and that matter suffers, that matter can be diseased and suffer. These propositions can only seem real and natural in illusion. So we get at once a sense, yes, here she has changed the tone after having shown the basis of sickness and how it can be healed. Now she asks, but is material disease, is matter really not something that suffers? Doesn't that suffer? And her answer is, no, look here, that suffering has not a real reality, a true reality. It is only a seeming. It seems real and natural, and it only seems so from which standpoint? From the standpoint of illusion, not from the standpoint of the divine mind. So if we have in that first epitome established the fact that all is mind and that we should go out from mind, then we are no more going out from illusion. Therefore, from that standpoint of mind, disease must appear to be unreal and no more real. So they are only real and natural in illusion. Any sense of soul in matter we have seen is what? It's pain and pleasure in matter. Any sense of soul in matter is not the reality of being. It has nothing to do with reality. So we get the sense that disease is unreal. If Jesus awakened Lazarus from the dream, illusion of death, see, she had before shown that they only seem real in illusion, that Jesus awakened Lazarus from that dream or illusion of death, this proved that the Christ could improve on a false sense. So we see here that the seeming can be improved, that the seeming reality can be disproved, and that we can improve on that sense, that there is the possibility of our spirit to unfold itself, to unfold its reality, and so that the case becomes better. So our epitome here we have is matter only suffers in illusion, not in reality. And Christ can improve on this false sense. So we can see that, will you explain to me sickness, she asks. Yes, we say matter cannot suffer. Will you explain me how it is to be healed? Yes, we can improve on that false sense because it's an illusion, and therefore through the mind of Christ, Jesus could resurrect Lazarus from his illusion and bring him back to reality. Then we go further, and here we have another break to soul. Who dares to doubt this consummate test of the power and willingness of the divine mind to hold man forever intact in his perfect state and govern man's entire action? You hear at once a completely different tone, the tone of soul, that she says, I have told you that mind is that which heals. It's mind that you take. With that power and willingness of the divine mind, you certainly can hold man intact. To hold man intact, can you see the tone of soul, the intactness of soul, the unchangeability of soul, that in soul everything is untouchable, that it cannot be distorted anymore, that we cannot lose it, that we not even need to gain it. It just always remains intact. An identity really means that something is what it is and never is anything else than what it is. So it's always intact. We have quite a good sense here that this mind can hold the perfect man intact. So that he wants to show that what Jesus actually did with Lazarus was not to to take him as a dead man and then make him alive. We know that very well from the chapter on spiritualism there. In that first part of life, Mrs. Eddy explains that if Jesus really would have believed that Lazarus had lived in matter and died in matter, that he would never have been able to resurrect Lazarus. Therefore, she wants to show there the standpoint from which we can help and heal is to go out from the standpoint here also of soul, that says that man has always been intact, so that he has never become sick, that out of that sickness he never died, and therefore that he does not need to be resurrected. He is always intact. And so Jesus said, destroy this temple or body, and in 3 days I, mind, will raise it up. Always 3 days. Jesus was always talking about 3 days when it had to do with resurrection. So three in the relative sense in the Bible always had the connotation of resurrection. I say in the relative sense, in the absolute sense, the three was always the Trinity of God, but in the relative sense, that three would always indicate that it takes three steps. It takes a step of mind and of spirit and of soul. These are the 3 days of creation, and in the third day of creation, the dry land appears. Therefore, the identity appears. Here too, he would always say, it takes 3 days. These are not calendar days, though perhaps effectually it has taken 3 days. But it is a spiritual concept. He could only resurrect him through a spiritual concept and not through a calendar concept of 3 days. And I, mind, will raise it up. So that mind, which is the basis of healing, which at the point of spirit shows to be real and the reality of being, is shown now to be a reality which has never lost its identity, which has always been kept intact. So Jesus could see that Lazarus was always intact, or else he could not have resurrected him. And for himself too, he had to see that his identity could never be touched, could never be destroyed, so that after 3 days he would show himself in the same way as before. And he did this for tired humanity's reassurance. So we get the sense here of soul, and if we read on, we still feel that this is a soul sense that Mrs. Eddy wants to bring out. She says, it is not a species of infidelity to believe that so great a work as the Messiah's was done for himself or for God, who needed no help from Jesus' example to preserve, can you hear, to preserve the eternal harmony. Side mark, you see, the preceding paragraph ended that Jesus did that for the tired humanity's reassurance. So in the next paragraph that we began to read, really she shows how that humanity can be reassured. So it is a further explanation of that short sentence after the semicolon. So she said Jesus didn't need that reassurance, and that he didn't do it for himself. He didn't do it for himself. He knew it anyway. Nor did he do it for God, who needed no help from Jesus' example, to preserve the eternal harmony, to keep harmony intact, to keep health intact. They didn't need it. But who needed it? For whom did Jesus do it? He did it for the people, for humanity. So she goes on, but mortals did need this help. Mortals needed it. So always, when you go back to the second chapter in the textbook, Atonement and Eucharist, that terrific chapter which Christian Scientists don't really like, that's the most terrific chapter for our life, really. There, Mrs. Eddy would always show, really, that it was really Jesus' love for humanity that he underwent all the persecution and all the misrepresentation and underwent the crucifixion. He did it for humanity's sake, not for himself. He could have, if he had wanted, to sit back into a quiet, nice place in Judah, or in Israel, those nice places, and he could have worked out his own salvation quietly without getting into trouble with anybody, and could have demonstrated it just as others did do that in the Old Testament, like Enoch did it, or Elijah did it. He could have done it too, but he would know that if he did it this way, that humanity would not be blessed, that it would have no impact on humanity. They had to see it and to tangibly touch it with their hands. They had to see it with their physical senses, what happened spiritually, and then perhaps they would believe it. So he did it for humanity's reassurance, but mortals, she says, did need this help. And Jesus pointed the way for them. He pointed the way for them. And I think for us, Jesus pointed it out, but the second chapter on Atonement and Eucharist points that out too. It is that terrific chapter which really we should not sidestep. We like the chapter on prayer because in prayer we are not so much challenged or practically not challenged, because we are within our closet and pray in quietude and silence. But then really one should be able to prove it in spite of opposing tendencies and powers. That's what Atonement and Eucharist will show, that we have to stay in that prayer in spite of opposition, so that we really can prove to ourselves that in spite of matter, in spite of body, in spite of people, in spite of death, in spite of disease, in spite of persecution, we really can work our salvation out. So that chapter, that second chapter, is full of the cross and of the burden, and therefore we should take up that chapter as a very important chapter, or else we will always stay in a prayerful attitude, in a contemplating attitude, in a study and research attitude. We still then, whatever we study then, whatever we study in the textbook, no matter which chapter, we still do it from the point of view of the first chapter on prayer. We never have really made it our own and have been willing to struggle through it, to be willing to take on ourselves the burden, to be willing to lay down the mortal. It's all about the laying down the mortal, laying down our personal sense of things. That struggle is necessary. Without that, we really cannot make any big living progress. So here again, she said, Jesus did it really for mortals' assurance, to help mortals, and Jesus pointed the way for them. Then we have that statement, divine love always has met and always will meet every human need. Now this is a statement with a synonymous term, love, in it, and we quote it as being loved, but we must see that it has a touch of soul in it, because what love is bringing out here really is that man will always remain intact, that he has no loss, that nothing is lacking, that everything is at his disposition, that always has met and always will meet every human need, indicating that love as soul, or that it's love that makes soul to be soul here, because we can see the intactness, the identity of Lazarus cannot be touched. The identity of Jesus' body through the resurrection could not be touched. And so also humanity's state of being cannot be touched. Every need will be met and will always be met. So that we can be reassured, really, that nothing will be taken away from us. That's I think nothing will be taken away from us. So, you always naturally you have to have a good tonality of the seven synonymous term, then you just hear this reassurance that nothing will ail you.